Hey guys, welcome to episode 177 of A True Crime Couple. I'm Kay.
And I'm John.
We hope you're all doing well and ready for another episode. But before we get started, I have to warn you all today that this episode is going to be a graphic one. It's one that involves talk about domestic violence and horrific crimes. But it's a story that needs to be told because it comes from a voice that is not often heard. So without any further ado, John, are you ready to hear something crazy?
Of course.
Police say the suspect, 31-year-old Jeffrey Dahmer, has confessed to the killings of 11 people whose remains were found in his apartment.
We are all evil in some form or another, are we not?
Lock your doors, lock your windows. If you have the ability to provide additional security devices, then by all means do so.
Our case today begins in the town of Crow Agency, Montana, which is located in the northern part of the Crow Native American Reservation. The reservation is the largest of the seven reservations in the state of Montana and the fifth largest reservation in the country. The reservation's borders were laid out in the Second Treaty of Fort Laramie in 1868. The provisions listed the land that the Crow were restricted to, but gave them permission to hunt and fish in certain areas outside of the reservation. In return, the Crow had to promise to give the United States government any Native American who was accused of wrongdoing against an American citizen, so they could be tried by American courts. In this agreement, the Crow had to cede a large portion of its land to the United States government. The Second Treaty of Fort Laramie was almost immediately broken upon its inception, much like the first treaty, and for the same reason, gold. As prospectors were discovering gold on the Crow Reservation or off the reservation but on the designated hunting land, more and more people started to move to the area. Now, I know I'm getting a little historical here, but I feel like it's an important thing to say because not a lot of people remember this part of history class.
No, it's a good point. And honestly, I always enjoy it, so.
Now, the reason why the prospectors coming to the reservation and the areas that are hunting areas is detrimental because this interferes with the land the Crow has already ceded, right? So if that land was designated to the Crow Native Americans, then nobody else should be settling that land. And it also negatively affected their way of life, meaning how they were prospecting around the areas that were designated for hunting. First of all, most Native American nations of the Great Plains were nomadic in nature, so restricting them to one area went against who they were. Secondly, for every acre that is settled in by prospectors, for example, or colonists earlier on in American history, it's estimated that that takes away 20 acres of hunting land.
I mean, that's pretty big.
Yes. And that restricts the Native Americans even further. And finally, by 1868, the buffalo of the Great Plains were nearly extinct. And this was an animal that the Great Plains Native Americans relied on for food, clothing, shelter, tools, jewelry, and ceremonies. However, at the onset of American westward expansion and the use of guns, the buffalo's numbers went from 30 million to 325 by 1884.
That's actually insane.
Yeah, and it was really because as railroads were being expanded westward, the buffalo is what was used for food to feed the men who were building the railroads.
Yeah, you know, it is when you really take the situation as a whole, it is really horrible because whether you're mining,
settling, doing
expansion for roadways or trains or anything like that, mm-hmm. whether it be this time or even if it was even present, let's say, then you're dealing with like oil and fracking and all these things, it really disrupts the land. So for a nomadic people like that, like you're talking about, like they can't develop on the land or hunt or do anything on it if the ground itself is no good anymore.
Right. And I think in that one statistic of saying like for every 1 acre that's settled, that takes away 20 acres of hunting land, that's going to be so detrimental to the way of life. But the whole idea was to Americanize the Native Americans as westward expansion was happening.
American history actually is interesting.
I remember
being a kid in school and not thinking that. But now being an adult and actually having a brain in my head, I think that actually is pretty interesting. Yeah, I feel like
that's how all the 15-year-olds feel in my class, too. So because of this near extinction of the buffalo and the fact that their hunting grounds were being encroached upon, the Crow and many other Native American tribes were restricted to only their reservations. And because of that, they had to live off food rations provided by the U.S. government, which of course are not going to be able to satiate them. It is a sad, frustrating history that exists between the U.S. government and the Native American communities. I tell my students it could be an entire year course, and we would still have more to talk about because much of the same is occurring today. There was actually just a Supreme Court case in 2019 where the Crow took the state of Wyoming all the way up to the Supreme Court because in the Second Treaty of Fort Laramie, which was upheld in the court decision in 2019, they are allowed to hunt outside of their designated area. So the way that the Crow Reservation sits in Montana is it's right at the border of Wyoming. Like it goes right down to it in a large portion of land. So the designated hunting land spread into Wyoming. The state of Wyoming was claiming that they weren't allowed to hunt in that land, that it was private property. But based on the Second Treaty of Fort Laramie, because the first one was such a joke, they are allowed to hunt there. And that was upheld by the Supreme Court in 2019.
That's so interesting. But also going back to like the 1800s, when that first treaty was signed, wasn't there also something where like they were given land, but the land really wasn't that good?
No, the problem was the land was too good. So the first treaty of Fort Laramie has to deal with land that's a little bit further to the east. And what happened was that was signed, but that was with the Sioux Nation. And in the Black Hills, they discovered gold.
I see. Okay.
So that's why that didn't work. And then there was an issue with something called the Bozeman Trail, which around these reservations. And now I'm going to go on a tangent. Sorry.
Sorry.
So around these reservations, what was really restrictive and was negative for the Native Americans was that although they were given this area of reservations, which was supposedly nice, there were all of these American military forts. And that's really intimidating, right? So you're given this designated area in the first Treaty of Fort Laramie by like the Sioux Nation. And there were 8 forts surrounding them. And to connect 2 forts, there was something called the Bozeman Trail. And there was a lot of problems surrounding this trail. So as men were traveling, like U.S. military men were traveling from fort to fort, they were passing by through with other Native Americans. And there were several things that happened where Native Americans were attacked or the U.S. military was attacked. So because of that, that like entered us into what will become Custer's Last Stand, the Battle of Little Bighorn, that's all surrounding that area.
These all sound familiar to me.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And the reason why George Custer was sent out there was because they wanted to set up another military fort after the discovery of gold in the Black Hills.
I would imagine, too, if you have 8 forts surrounding an area, it's almost like an open-air prison. I mean,
that's what it is.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, that's kind of crazy. But anyway.
And that's one of the worst military blunders in American history.
You know, you're making me want to open up a book and learn some history. I almost forgot that we're doing a true crime podcast.
I know. I'm sorry, guys. So the Crow Reservation is neighbored on the east by the Northern Cheyenne Reservation, which was featured on our episode about Hannah Harris, and that's episode 147. The Cheyenne Reservation is considerably smaller, though, than this Crow Reservation, but that's not the only Cheyenne Reservation. The Cheyenne Reservation, the Northern Cheyenne Reservation, was 444,000 acres. The Crow Reservation that we will be talking about in today's episode is 2.3 million acres. So it is, again, like I said before, the biggest reservation in the state of Montana. In that area, 7,900 of the 11,000 enrolled members of the Crow Nation live there. Because this reservation is so sparsely populated, it has a majestic, open feel about it. However, the tables can quickly be turned if you're in need of help. And all that open space and the fact that you can drive for hours without seeing another soul can make the area seem desolate and scary. But that privacy and desolation was something that a man named Steve Peterson was appreciating on the afternoon of April 17th, 2016. He had been making his monthly drive up to Montana to check on cattle that he kept at a ranch in an area nearby. But the drive was a long one, so he had to stop and use the bathroom. The trip was one that he often made, so he had this kind of like designated spot where he would be able to stop and pee in privacy. That's like when we take our trip to North Carolina, we always have those same rest stops we stop at.
I mean, yeah, because we don't want to ever go off the beaten path.
No.
You know?
Because we always can't find 95 again.
And you know, we always get lost in the same spot all the time.
So there was a road that he would turn down, and this is called Castle Rock Road. And it's just off of Highway 212, which he was on. So he could kind of pull down that road and be out of sight if somebody passes. Now, Highway 212 travels across the Great Plains from Minnesota to Montana. It passes through three reservations, the Cheyenne River Reservation in South Dakota and the Northern Cheyenne Reservation. It actually passes through Lame Deer, where Hannah Harris was from, and it ends in the Crow Reservation just outside of the town of Crow Agency, where a national monument for the Battle of Little Bighorn is located. Because it's like kind of in this whole area.
Gotcha.
So there Steve was, looking to relieve himself after a long drive, politely away from anyone who might by chance drive by, which would be rare. As he was making his way out of the truck, he heard a sound. Something he would not expect, because driving in that area, it's just about as desolate as you can get. But it was a person that sounded like they were in a lot of pain. When he looked around at the side of the road, he was shocked. At first, he thought it was a baby calf. And then he realized that, in fact, the sounds he heard, like his first thought process was true. It was a person. It was the body of a woman. She was naked from the waist down. She looked as though she had been beaten up very badly. His first thought was to grab a sleeping bag from his truck, cover her up, and drive her to the nearest hospital, which would be in Crow Agency. He went to retrieve the sleeping bag, but when he came back and looked at her, he had second thoughts. Now, this woman is alive.
Right. Like, she's obviously in serious condition and in pain.
Well, yeah. And as he's given her this second look, he's realizing that she's in such horrible shape that he couldn't move her. Now that he really got to look at her, he could see that the upper part of her body had been horrifically burned. He feared moving her would be painful and mess up the burned skin.
That's smart. See, this person's thinking. Mm-hmm. I mean, what a situation to be in, though. Seriously, like, you're really making a decision for this person that you don't even know who they are.
Yeah, and you did not expect this to happen.
Yeah.
And what are the chances that this is the spot where he pulls off, right?
Unbelievable.
It would be impossible for her to be picked up by him. And he had no medical background, so he was kind of like, I need to get assistance here. As he thought about what to do, you know, like to call law enforcement, he tried to first assist the woman as best as he could, right? Because obviously she was in a lot of distress. So he covered her with the sleeping bag to warm her up. The nights in Montana in early spring are cold, and it was evident that she had been outside for a while because the parts of her body that were not burned had frostbite.
So whatever happened to this lady? I mean, they must have left her out there all night.
Yeah. He wanted to give her something to drink, but all he had was a can of soda. He tried to give her some, but her mouth had been swollen shut. He was able to find a straw, and eventually she was able to drink that way. Luckily, soon after this, he heard a car approaching. Maybe he could figure out what to do with someone else. He flagged down the vehicle, and in another stroke of luck, he found that the person driving was an officer from the Bureau of Indian Affairs.
Perfect.
So law enforcement. The man confirmed that the woman's injuries were too bad for them to bring her themselves to the nearest hospital. He didn't even think the nearest hospital would be able to treat her. It was a miracle that this woman was still alive. So together they call emergency services and, you know, coming from a law enforcement agent, like knowing exactly who to call, what, so that's going to kind of speed up this process a little bit. When they arrived, her condition was assessed and it was eventually determined that she needed critical care, care of which they could not provide at the Crow Agency Hospital. So once they bring her to Crow Agency Hospital and they assess the fact that she's beyond the help that they could provide because they don't have like a burn unit. So she has to be airlifted to the nearest hospital that could treat her injuries. And that was in Salt Lake City at the University of Utah Hospital, just over 600 miles away.
Well, I mean, this is an insane situation. The only good thing, though, is if she's at least there at that hospital, they can kind of give her, I don't want to say stabilized, because I think she's past that point, but at right. least to kind of minimize any further damage or right. suffering until that she can be airlifted. You know what I mean?
Right.
Better than just laying on the floor.
They can give her pain medicine. And
yeah. Exactly. Yeah, I mean.
Bandage her wounds.
Something.
So luckily, the woman was able to speak to investigators through this process of her, like them deciding where they were going to send her. And she was able to tell them who she was and where she had been the night that she was attacked. Her name was Roy Lynn Rideshorse. And she had been at the Kirby Saloon on April 16th with her boyfriend. So it's incredible that this woman, A, survived her injuries, because I'll get into them later, and B, was able to tell investigators not just who she was, but where she was. So she's going to give them a good direction.
I mean, she might even be able to tell them like exactly what happened and who did it.
That's a little too hard.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right.
So the Bureau of Indian Affairs, the BIA, officers were tasked with contacting Roiland's family and letting them know what happened. Ernestine Pretty Weasel is Roiland's mother. She explained that Roiland was the middle of her three children. She loved her children with the intensity only a mother could. And she had been concerned about Roiland, or Lynn, as her family called her for short, for some time. She felt as if she was in, and she was, in a very abusive relationship. And she wanted her daughter and her grandson to get out of it and be safe, because Lynn had a 2-year-old son with her boyfriend, Oliver Half. The weekend before, on April 14th, Lynn, Oliver, and their son came to stay with them, meaning her mother, for the weekend. The following day, Ernestine had noticed that her daughter had bruising on her body, and she asked if Oliver was responsible for it. Her daughter didn't reply and was evasive with her mother's questions. The plan had been for the couple to leave the following day, but her mother tried to convince her to stay with her son. She didn't want her daughter to leave with Oliver. She, you know, kind of went into protective mode because she knew their relationship was this toxic cycle of abuse, and she wanted to keep safe both her daughter and her grandson. So she's saying, stay with me, like, don't leave with him.
That's really sad.
Roiland had met Oliver Half in 2013. Her mother and cousin said that Lynn was a beautiful person, both inside and out. All she wanted in life was to love and to be loved. She was friendly. She was known as a peacemaker. Like, she really just wanted people to like her. She was a people pleaser. She wanted to make friends. She was joyful when people liked her.
I mean, those are actually really good qualities to have, right? Yeah. I mean, God, it's so sad to like see like people like this get these terrible things that happen to them, right? I mean, yeah. Every story that you tell me and I sit here and I listen, it's like, you know, it's all good people, you know, but it's sad when they're taken advantage of or something happens like this. It's just,
it's really devastating.
It really hurts. Yeah,
it does.
Yeah.
So when she had met Oliver in 2013, she'd been thinking about going to college. She really wanted to be a nurse practitioner so she could help people. But when she met Oliver, those dreams ceased to be, because this meant that she could be a mother, something that she always dreamed of, and like kind of have her happily ever after. Lynn loved Oliver and had been excited for her friends and family to meet him. But when they did, they found that the two were a bit of an odd couple. Where Lynn was warm and inviting, Oliver was quiet and cold. Still, they were happy for Lynn because she seemed to be happy. And in retrospect, her cousin said that she believed that Lynn was just looking for someone to love her, and she thought she found that in Oliver. Later that same year, Lynn discovered that she and Oliver were pregnant. She told her mother that she was so happy. She would have a baby. Oliver had a great job at the coal strip mine, and the couple had just found a beautiful home to rent. It seemed like everything was coming together. But that happiness was short-lived. Once the couple moved in together, a different side of Oliver was revealed. He was very controlling of everything Lynn did. He wanted to have a decision in everything that happened with her and their family. The abuse was verbal and emotional at first, and then eventually became physical. The cycle of violence that is ever present with abusers became the cycle in which Lynn lived. The abuse, the apology and love bombing, and then the abuse again. Both because this was happening in Lynn's life and because Oliver wanted to control her, Lynn began to push away her family so they wouldn't know what was happening, and because that's the way Oliver preferred it. Ernestine had tried to speak with her daughter about the concern she had for her. Early on, when Lynn was still pregnant and her mother had come over to visit, she noticed bruising on her daughter's arm and told her that she wanted her daughter to leave with her right away. So kind of same thing. Just come with me. Come back to my house. I'll help you raise my future grandchild. I just want you to be safe. But Lynn refused. Her family knew that Lynn was not going to leave Oliver. They said that she loved him and she wanted him to love her back, and that she had faith that he would get better and be the person she saw him as.
And that's what always happens. It's almost like those two personalities, when they get into a relationship, it's so bad for the one that thinks that, you know, there's a light at the end of the tunnel, that there is a way to fix that person. Like, oh, he does all these negative things, but I can change him. That is wishful thinking, and you cannot blame them for thinking that way, because based on what we've learned about her, she is a very upbeat and likable person that, you know, everyone is they gravitate towards her. But
right.
When you're in a relationship like that, it's just not going to work, and it's always going to be at your detriment. You know?
And that's the way the cycle of abuse really does work. And that's the point of the love bombing and the apology, because there's high highs and there's low lows. But the thought process of the person who's being abused is, well, when it's good, it's really good. And maybe we can get to a point where it's always really good.
Right.
But that's not the reality of these relationships. But that's how the abusers manipulate.
Right. And Lynn's mom, I mean, you know, she doesn't want to see her future grandchild have to grow up in an environment like that, where that kid might witness abuse taking place in the house and maybe even towards the kid in the future.
Exactly.
You have no idea. And that's what I think she's really trying to push for, that. Like, hey, come with me. We don't have to deal with this anymore.
Right. And it's a tricky place for a family to be in, because they don't want to lose contact with their loved one either. Because if the pushback continues, then that might eventually mean the door closes.
That's true.
But even though she hoped that he would eventually become better to her, it seemed like it wasn't happening. which was why when Ernestine had seen the bruising on April 15th, 2016, she pleaded with her daughter to leave, well, to not leave with Oliver the following day, but to leave him. And that meant that the abuse was going on for 3 years, and now her grandson was witnessing it, potentially a part of it.
Right. Quick question.
Mm-hmm.
Just to kind of give a more clear timeline. The last time, this incident when she sees the bruising and says a second time, come stay with me with your kid.
Yeah.
How many days was that before the
discovery?
The discovery of her body all, you know, burnt and everything.
2 days.
Okay.
So what's going to happen is the last time that she sees her daughter is going to be on the 15th.
Okay.
The attack happens on the 16th, but her body is found on the 17th.
Okay.
That's the timeline.
That makes me have so many questions. Where's Oliver? You know, like, mm-hmm. what's his involvement in this? Like, a lot of things are starting to, like, kind of go in my mind. But, yeah, it's really important because I'm thinking, did he get wind that she, once again, the mother, tried to get her to come,
right?
You know, stay with her and leave him? And that would make someone like him flip out.
Yeah. Potentially.
Potentially, right?
But even though her mother asked her not to leave, she did. She left with Oliver and their son and went about the plans they had. Despite being a little distant, Lynn always picked up her phone when her mother called. And if she couldn't, she would always call back as soon as she could if her mother left a voicemail. However, that was not the case the day her daughter left the house. Ernestine kept calling, and the phone kept going to voicemail. That night, and this is the night of the attack, it had been hard for Ernestine to sleep because she kept wondering what was wrong with her daughter and why she wasn't returning her phone calls. And her mother's intuition had been right.
I was just going to say mother's intuition. Mm-hmm.
When the BIA agent had called Ernestine, she was with her mother and sister. They were out shopping. When the man on the other line said that she needed to come home immediately, she knew it had to be about Lynn, who still had not returned her call. Without saying anything to her mother or sister, she left where they were and rushed home. When she got home, the officers were already in the dining room with her husband, Lynn's stepfather. They asked her to sit down, and then they let her know that Lynn had been found in extremely critical condition on Castle Rock Road, and because of that, she had to be taken to a hospital in Salt Lake City to be cared for. Ernestine and Lynn's family came over immediately to help her and rally around her. The family told investigators about Lynn's relationship, and they said that their main concern now was Lynn's son. If she had been with Oliver at the Kirby Saloon, then what happened to her afterwards? And they wanted to ensure that her son was safe.
Right, because we're potentially dealing with Oliver being the person that might have done this to her, and we don't want Oliver around this kid, you know?
Especially if he was desperate enough or aggressive enough to have attacked her the way that she was attacked.
And, I mean, God forbid, but also what we're putting the kid in a lot of danger. What if he did something to the kid? There's like so many things that we need to get to the bottom of like right now.
Right. Or there is that like second possibility that maybe the entire family was attacked.
Well, that's true too, depending on where they went and who they met there. That's true too.
Mm-hmm. So the investigators explained to the family that they were going to begin their investigation at the Kirby Saloon because that was where Lynn had last been. And at the same time, they were going to attempt to find Oliver. So they're basically telling the family, we're going to have two lines open where one group of investigators is going to be looking into Oliver and your grandson, and the other is going to go to Kirby Saloon.
I mean, that's a pretty decent response if you think about it. They're not putting anything off to the side here. They're attacking you from different fronts.
No. And I think they're attacking of the investigation was good. Later on, the family will say that one major problem they were having with the investigators was that they were just not communicating with them, or telling them what was happening. Okay. So they might be great investigators and what they were doing was correct, but the family was definitely not in the know. And that was something that was really stressful too, because they're also dealing with Lynn's condition.
Right.
But that'll pop up later on. But before we get any further, I wanted to take a moment here to talk about the sponsor of today's show, Miracle Made. Did you know that your temperature at night can have one of the greatest impacts on your sleep quality? If you wake up too hot or too cold, I highly recommend you check out Miracle Made's bed sheets. Inspired by NASA, Miracle Made uses silver-infused fabrics and makes temperature-regulating bedding so you can sleep at the perfect temperature all night long. Miracle Made sheets have self-cooling properties for better quality sleep that uses silver-infused fabrics inspired by NASA. Miracle Made sheets are thermoregulating and designed to keep you at the perfect temperature all night long, so you get better sleep every night. And these sheets are self-cleaning. Because they're infused with that silver, they prevent up to 99.7% of bacterial growth, leaving them to stay cleaner and fresh 3 times longer than other sheets. That means no more gross odors. And on top of it all, they are high quality and so comfortable. With Miracle Made, you are getting the luxury without the high price tag. And these sheets are designed for your skin. Stop sleeping on bacteria. Bacteria can clog your pores, cause breakouts, and acne. Sleep clean with Miracle. We love using our Miracle Made sheets. It is really the only time I feel like we've been sleeping and we don't wake up sweating or like feeling gross. I feel like every time we get into the sheets, it's just clean. And that's the best feeling. Go to trymiracle.com/TCC to get Try Miracle Made sheets today. And whether you're buying them for yourself or as a gift for your loved one, if you order today, you can save over 40%. And if you use our promo code TCC at checkout, you'll get 3 free towels and save an extra 20%. Miracle is so confident in their product, it's backed with a 30-day money-back guarantee. So if you aren't 100% satisfied, you'll get a full refund. Upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Go to trymiracle.com/TCC and use code TCC to claim your free 3-piece towel set and save over 40%. Again, that's trymiracle.com/TCC to treat yourself. Thank you, Miracle, for sponsoring this episode. Okay, let's get back to the show. So in fact, as Lynn's family was being told about her discovery, law enforcement officers from the BIA were already at the Kirby Saloon. Because there had been no evidence found at the scene of discovery, this was the only lead that they had, and it was a lead from the victim, so it was the first thing they were going to follow up on. Now, I just want to explain the geographics to you here. The Crow Reservation extends to the south to the border of Wyoming. And on its east side, it's just about a straight line, like the border of the reservation is a straight line. The Cheyenne, the Northern Cheyenne Reservation, shares a border with just under half of the east side of the Crow Reservation.
Okay.
So where the east of the Crow Reservation meets the west of the Cheyenne Reservation, it's a straight line. However, because the Crow Reservation is larger, it extends further south. In the non-reservation space that is south of the Cheyenne Reservation sits the Kirby Saloon. Now, this is important that it's in this location because they are allowed to have the heavy alcohol there.
So you're telling me that this is located, this bar, outside of the reservation?
Correct. And because it's only a mile south of the Cheyenne Reservation and a mile west of the Crow, a lot of Crow and Cheyenne go to this Kirby Saloon.
Right.
It's a hot spot to go to.
So I see what you're saying. So now we're opening up the possibility that this could be someone that doesn't live on a reservation or someone that lives on a different reservation.
Potentially. And now this is the same situation, actually, that we had with the Hannah Harris case, because remember they went to Jim's bar.
Yes, and I remember that. That's why I'm asking that question, mm-hmm. because now you do really open up the floodgates for
potential
who we're
suspects.
Exactly, like who we're looking for here.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So if you are at the saloon, you're only a mile from each reservation in their respective directions. In order to get back to Crow Agency, so I'm just giving you this, the whole thing, because that's what was happening, is that they had gone from Crow Agency to this Kirby Saloon. So in order to get from Kirby Saloon to Crow Agency, you would have to travel north 13 miles into the Cheyenne Reservation until you hit Busby. And I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right. But for you history people, that's where George Custer's camp was. And then you're going to travel 24 miles west on Highway 212. And that will take you back to Crow Agency. So this bar was far. And that's where you would have to travel to drink. Lynn had been found on Castle Rock Road, which is off of Highway 212. So somehow she got 20 miles from the bar. Somebody had taken her north to get all the way to Highway 212, which was a 13-mile trip, and then they headed west on Highway 212 towards Crow Agency for 6 of the 24 miles needed to get home. So how did she get there? Why was she left there? And these were the answers that the BIA were looking for.
Well, it does sound like something must have happened either at the bar or while leaving the bar, right?
Right.
So I'm thinking, are we dealing with someone who's in the other reservation that went into the Crow, dropped her off a few miles in to dispose of her, thinking that maybe she would have died, like she would die,
right,
and then go back to the reservation? Because if they brought the body to the other reservation, it wouldn't make sense. It would look out of place if they found her there.
Then what happened to Oliver?
I mean, that's a good question.
Because she was at the bar with Oliver.
I think a lot of things will be more clear when we find out his involvement and where he is.
Good point.
Right? I mean, that's really the big thing we're missing here. Once we have that, then we might be able to determine who is responsible, whether it be someone from another reservation, the husband, or somebody who doesn't live on the reservation.
I completely agree.
You know?
The agent asked the owner of the saloon for the surveillance video of the bar that night. He wanted the footage downloaded. However, as he was trying to get the footage from the prior night up, a problem arose with the system.
Of course.
Always. There's always a problem with technology. So the owner said that he would have to call the company to fix the technical issues and that that might take some time. And it did take a few days to retrieve the video.
I mean,
Yeah, but it's hugely detrimental to the investigation.
I mean, I think any day prolonged is not really good here.
Right.
So yeah, I guess you're right.
So while he was there, the agent decided to question some of the patrons at the bar. Because it was the only place to drink for a while, many of the same people frequented the bar. So it was more than likely that people that were there the night before were there that night. So he was able to find some people that said that they remembered seeing Roylyn and Oliver at the bar that night, and that the couple had been fighting very badly. She was visibly upset and crying at the bar. Their victim had gotten into a fight with her abusive boyfriend, so it was really time to speak with Oliver.
I was just thinking too, like, side note here, though. You know, like, think about it. You know, when you have, let's say, something happen in a neighborhood, you canvass the area, right?
Right.
In this case, you're canvassing the bar. But, like, how good are the people that you're asking questions that have been there drinking? Like, I'm just making a joke of that. But, like, you know, like, you don't know actually how good the information is.
Are you kidding me? 3 margaritas in at where we go to drink?
I mean, I guess
I'm
right.
Watching everybody.
It's like a truth serum.
Yeah, I could tell you everything that happened.
But I'm just saying, like, you know, I'm sure you do have a few people that are like, well, you know, you really can't.
If something like stands out, and the fact that this couple had a fight, people remembered it.
No, definitely. And they were saying it was bad.
It was a bad fight, and that she was crying at the bar.
Right.
Well, this point of the story brings us back to Lynn's family, who are still gathered at Lynn's mother's house. The biggest concern for the family, other than the well-being of Lynn, who they planned to go see in Utah the following day, were the whereabouts of Lynn's 2-year-old son. Since the BIA and other federal law enforcement learned about the involvement of a child, they tried to get a hold of Oliver. And because they couldn't get a hold of him or find him anywhere, they put out an Amber Alert on the 2-year-old son that had a description of Oliver and his vehicle.
That's a good first step, yes. Right?
And at this point, the family really believed that Oliver was the person that was responsible for what happened to Lynn, because how could he not be? While they were all at the house helping Ernestine and the immediate family, someone's phone rang amongst all the phones that were on the counter. They were shocked to see that calling was the very person they were looking for, Oliver.
What? All right.
But when the phone was answered, he didn't offer any sympathy, any assurances that the son he shared with Lynn was safe, or concern for Lynn. Instead, he was furious about the Amber Alert. He screamed threats at the mourning family. He said he was going to show up at the house and he was going to shoot them all. Lynn's family immediately called law enforcement to let them know about the threat. And when they had been talking to him, he said that he was at the house that he had rented with Lynn. So they said, Oliver's at the house. We don't know if he has his son, our grandson, with him, but he's threatening to kill us all. Because Oliver was the number one suspect in this brutal assault and his son had an Amber Alert issued out on him, he had known weapons and he was threatening violence, the BIA went to the scene with guns blazing. Now, Oliver came out brandishing a gun, which prompted the agents to all point their weapons at him. For 5 hours, Oliver was in a standoff with the BIA and other federal law enforcement agents.
That's crazy. Like you haven't even... What's crazy to me is that this guy is doing all this, but no one's really cracking down on him yet. The police haven't even gotten him in custody to ask him even a question.
Well, they've been looking for him.
I mean, I agree with that.
They didn't know where he was. Now that they do, they're in a standoff with him. They're like, this guy's dangerous, and he has his son with him inside the home.
No, I know. And this is crazy, but it's going from like 0 to 100. I mean, I understand being mad. Like, let's say you'd had no involvement in what happened and now all of a sudden the police are looking for you and your son. I can understand like why you could be mad, but then to threaten the rest of the family, you're going to kill him. And then now you're having a standoff. It's just wild to me.
Well, that's because this shows his temper and how he loses control when he loses control of a situation.
Right. And honestly, I think that he's doing himself no favors here. If he's capable of all these things, whether it be verbal or now what he's doing with police,
right?
They're going to believe that he is truly involved in what happened to Lynn.
Yeah, I mean, that's who they think they're dealing with at this moment.
At this point, there's no other person that it looks like except him.
Well, sometime after the 5 hours, finally, one of the agents had the opportunity to rush Oliver. And that's how they were able to finally end the standoff and arrest him. Once he was arrested, they were able to find that the son that he shared with Lynn in the house was alive and well. He was put in the immediate custody of his grandmother, Ernestine.
Good.
So now that Oliver was in custody, law enforcement agents wanted to question him and search his vehicle. When his truck was searched, nothing of Lynn's was found in the car. They processed the vehicle and they couldn't even find any of her DNA. No touch DNA, no hairs, nothing. Lynn's family thought this was odd because this was the vehicle that the couple shared. Not only was Lynn always in the truck, but she would drive it on occasion. So this made them and law enforcement all even more suspicious of Oliver. They thought that he was trying to cover something up. But when they questioned Oliver, it seemed he knew nothing about the condition in which Lynn was in. When they questioned him, he seemed very off-put, angry that he was there. He was not a good guy. He was abusing Lynn, a woman who loved him and was desperate to be loved by him and have a family with him. Through a back and forth with law enforcement, the situation was laid out for him. You tried to kill the mother of your child after the two of you got into a fight at the Kirby Saloon. He was furious at what they were saying because he's thinking, like, Lynn is telling them that he tried to kill her. And he's like, is that what that, like, B is saying about me? And law enforcement kind of said to him, like, she's not saying much of anything. And they went into detail about her condition. And he acted like he knew nothing about her being hurt like that. They asked him if he drove out to a dirt road and lit her on fire. And he was very confused. And he demanded to know what had happened to Lynn.
Okay, so the phone call that he had with Lynn's mom was that way. Well, not the whole threatening part, but not feeling remorseful or anything due to the fact that he actually had no idea is what it seems like right now.
Yeah. Yeah, because he was trying to figure out what was happening to Lynn. But once they laid out to him what happened to her and that they were thinking he did it, he then completely shuts down and doesn't want to speak with them.
Interesting.
Unfortunately, without the footage from the bar that night yet, and the fact that nothing of Lynn's was found in the truck, they had to let him go. Oliver left the area quickly after his release and the return of his truck. His mother lived in Arizona, and that's where Lynn's family thinks he went. He never visited Lynn in the hospital, nor did he ever call to check on the well-being of his son.
I mean, that's so bizarre, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, like, I know that you might have had some issues with your wife, and obviously you did not handle that correctly and you were abusive, but to not have to relinquish the control and just get rid of everyone and just dart off.
Yeah.
I find that interesting, right? Because someone that has been controlling her and being abusive just cuts ties and runs is weird.
I think what he was saying is, look at the condition of Lynn. He no longer wants to be with her.
I see.
So he's gone. And then that would mean, you know, if God forbid she doesn't survive this, then he would have to take care of his son by himself. And he doesn't want that responsibility. I want to do that.
Okay. All right. I see what you're saying.
And that's just assumptions on my part. You know, I don't know for a fact.
No,
but
I mean, I think that you're onto something. I mean, it could be.
And we also don't know if he has since been involved in his son's life.
Right.
So next I'm going to speak about what happened to Lynn as a result of her attack. So I just want to warn you in advance because it's very rough. So if you don't want to hear it, you can fast forward about a minute. So while that was happening, the question of Oliver, Lynn's family arrived in Salt Lake City on April 18th to see her the following day. When they got there, they were told by the doctor that she had lost a lot of blood. And because of the attack she sustained, her kidneys had failed, so she was placed on dialysis. Lynn also had horrible second and third degree burns on 50% of her body. And in some places, on her back specifically, there was no soft tissue remaining at all, and she would need skin grafts. She had also been beaten badly, and she had many wounds from the blunt force trauma that she received to her head and her stomach. She had been lit on fire with use of an accelerant, which they determined to be gasoline. When the accelerant had been poured on her, she inhaled some of the liquid. And when she was put on fire, it traveled into her throat and up her face. From the fire, both her nose and lips were gone. She had lost sight in one of her eyes. Because she had been left out in the elements overnight, she was also suffering from frostbite on her legs and feet. Her survival was a miracle. And her strength was truly unmatched, but she would have a long, painful road ahead, and her family was warned that she wasn't out of the woods yet. She was still in extremely critical condition.
I mean, to be put through what this woman has been put through and is still hanging on.
Yeah.
Ah, jeez, is incredible, but sad that someone even did this.
How could you do this to another human being?
Seriously.
Ernestine said that the first day they got there, that her husband went in to see Lynn, and when he came out, he was quiet. She didn't ask how bad it was, because it was evident on his face that it was unimaginable. Her family was left wondering Not just who could do this to a person, as sweet and peaceful as their Lynn was, but how could someone have done this to anyone? It was hard for Ernestine to see her daughter like that. And while other members of the family were there and visiting Lynn, she let them visit because the time in which Lynn could see people was a little bit limited because she had to go in for so many treatments and surgeries. So when it was time for her to see people, her mother let other people go, especially because those people had to leave and go back to work in Montana.
Right.
So eventually Ernestine found herself in Salt Lake City by herself. Her husband had to go back for work, but said he would return shortly. She still hadn't brought herself to see her daughter in the state she was in, but she was there every minute that she wasn't sleeping. Finally, a doctor came out before a procedure to let Ernestine know that Lynn had said she wanted someone to be with her because she was scared. So she went in. At first, she said she had her eyes closed, but she let Lynn know that she was there. Finally, when she opened her eyes, she said her daughter was completely unrecognizable. But after that, Ernestine spent all her time with her daughter, something the hospital allowed, knowing it was good for her to be with Lynn.
I mean, yeah. I mean, when you're going through all those things, you want support. You
yeah,
know?
And comfort in some yeah. way, because you're so far away from home, too. Ernestine said that she would play gospel music for her daughter, and she could see her moving her feet beneath the blanket. She talked to Lynn and let her know how loved she was and how strong she was. She tried hard not to let her voice crack in front of her or cry because she didn't want her daughter to think that she was making anyone upset. She tried to be just as strong as Lynn was. But the doctors had not lied about Lynn not being out of the woods yet. She had more surgeries than her mother could count, and things weren't going well. Because of the advanced frostbite and the fever that she was developing because of it, the doctors had to remove both of Lynn's feet. She also developed sepsis from an infection after the skin grafting surgeries on her back. While Lynn continued the fight for her life in Utah, the agents finally got what they had been waiting for, the footage from the bar the night that Lynn had been attacked. On the video, they were able to see that Lynn and Oliver had gotten into an argument there. At one point, the couple left the bar, and it's unclear what happened outside of the bar, but only Lynn returned back.
Okay, so it seems like maybe they got into an argument. It got so heated that he left.
He left her there.
She decided to stay there.
Well, no.
Oh.
What ended up happening was that, and what they were able to determine through speaking with Oliver again, he left her at the bar.
Okay, so he just ditched her because, you know, he doesn't care about her at all.
Exactly.
Okay.
So she can be seen going to the bar, and she's visibly upset and crying. After some time, she gets up and she could be seen going around to various patrons at the bar, and later it would be determined that what she was doing was she was asking for rides back to Crow Agency.
Okay, yeah, so now she's trying to hitchhike. So now she's being put in a situation where she has no idea who would be taking her home. Fantastic.
Because now they see it. There she was, a victim of domestic violence, abandoned in a bar 38 miles from home, left to desperately seek help, left in an incredibly vulnerable situation. She was unable to find a ride, and she sat down at the bar, still upset. Finally, a woman approached her with a man behind her. The two had a conversation, and Lynn asked the woman for a ride. A short while later, Lynn left with the couple.
Okay, so left with two people?
A couple.
Okay.
The same exact thing that happened to Hannah Harris from episode 147.
Yes. That is so strange.
A couple picked her up from a bar. And that's scary because you think you're safe because you're with another woman.
But that's probably not the case. Question, though.
Yeah.
Did they know each other? Did is this like the first time that seen them? Okay.
First time. And because this is the same thing that happened to Hannah Harris, only almost 10 years later, 9 years, I'm going to repeat the same statistic that I did in episode 147 because I feel like you know, if we say it enough, maybe people will realize how crazy these statistics are. In 2016, there was a report that stated that there were 5,700 reports of missing and murdered Indigenous women across the United States. And later, the U.S. Department of Justice would say that Native American women are murdered at 10 times the national average. A statistic that is only made more crazy by the fact that their per capita population is so much lower than a regular city.
Yeah.
So the fact that you would expect it to be lower because their population's lower, it's 10 times higher. And that shows how vulnerable these women are. And now here is Roy Lynn, a woman who's vulnerable for just existing, and now is placed in this even more vulnerable situation by her abusive boyfriend.
Yeah.
Which is also very common.
It's terrible. Because she didn't even need to be in that position to begin with. I'm talking about at the bar. You know, right. That did not need to happen. With random people that she doesn't know, she wouldn't be asking for rides home.
And how dangerous that is. And especially because the way that she's going home is such a desolate drive.
It is.
Anything could happen there.
You said what, 38 miles?
38 miles, yeah.
That's a long way from home on foot.
She can't walk home. Yeah. So because the world of the reservations are a small one and people tend to know each other, especially, you know, frequenting the bar, the saloon, the man on tape was recognized as a man named Frank Sanchez. Frank Sanchez is from Lame Deer in the Northern Cheyenne Reservation, also where Hannah Harris was from. It's known that there are some members of the Cheyenne who do not like the Crow and vice versa. There seems to be a bit of an animosity amongst the two communities. Their history is a complicated one, as is most Native American community interactions. Historically, their animosity could date back to the fact that they were two separate nomadic tribes that competed for hunting space in the same area. And in more recent history, there are disputes between the two that were fueled dramatically by American westward expansion. And they were fights for survival that both groups had. And sometimes that led to complicated interactions and relationships amongst Native American communities together based on their involvement or aggression towards U.S. government. And it's not something that's felt by all, but it's definitely something that's culturally present that these two groups share some historical animosity.
Okay.
So that was a factor when Frank Sanchez was identified because he's from the Northern Cheyenne Reservation.
Okay. Now, hold on. But that's big because it goes back to what I was saying earlier.
Yes, I know. You said it. I was like, oh, darn.
Even though I was a little all over the place, I was trying to pinpoint that, like, you wouldn't want to dump a body from, you know, you want to dump the body of someone, you know, that lives on that reservation, in that reservation. You wouldn't want to dump it where you live.
Right.
So that, you know, it makes sense that, like, is this person now the person we're looking for?
Right. You were saying maybe they were from the Northern Cheyenne Reservation. Yes. Well, now investigators want to talk to Frank Sanchez and see what he knows about that night. Law enforcement agents set up a meeting with Frank on April 20th. 3 days after the discovery of Lynn on Castle Rock Road. They asked Frank if he had been at the Kirby Saloon that night, and he said that he had not been, that he had been at home. They showed him the footage that they had of him at the bar, and he let them know that that wasn't him on the video. Instead, it was his brother, DiMarzio.
His brother.
His brother.
Okay.
Now, both of them at this time were 21 years old, and I couldn't find if they're twins or stepbrothers, but they're both 21. And if they are twins, it would make sense that, oh, that's not me, that's my twin brother.
Oh, so they're trying to, like, maybe one's trying to pawn it off on the other?
Well, you'll see.
Okay.
Okay. So the agents try to find an address for DiMarzio, and they find out that they won't have to go far to find him because he's already in custody for unrelated charges.
Oh. Great.
Perfect. So they quickly go to him. Just like his brother, he denied being at the bar that night. But when they showed him the video, he had to admit that he was there.
Yeah, well, the video doesn't lie.
No. He said that that was him. He was with his girlfriend, who was also in the video. Her name was Angelica Whiteman. And that the two of them gave Lynn a ride.
So they're pretty much there admitting to being the last people to see her before her injuries.
Yes. He said that he dropped her off at a nearby trailer park in Dunmore. And the last he saw her, she was alive and well, walking into a trailer. And then he and Angelica left. Now, this is interesting because being from Lame Deer, he must know about the Hannah Harris case. And we know that Hannah Harris met her demise in a trailer park.
Yes.
So I'm wondering if he's replaying that story.
Oh, wow. You know, that's actually a really good point.
Yeah. So that's what he says. He said he left her at a trailer park. She was alive and well. We got out of there. So they ask him where exactly this trailer park was, but he said he couldn't remember because it was dark and he'd been drinking. So wonderful thing to admit to while you were the one who was driving. Because there was no physical evidence against him and they knew he wasn't going anywhere, they chose to stop their line of questioning because he wasn't being helpful. Instead, they wanted to find Angelica Whiteman. Maybe, they hoped, she would be more cooperative. But finding Angelica was harder than they initially thought it would be. There were records of her living in Lame Deer, but it was like she completely disappeared. While the BIA and other federal agents were looking for her, the case came to a halt because there was no other evidence. Lynn's family was frustrated at this point because this is where they believed, well, they felt like there was a massive lack of communication and they weren't being told what was happening. So that's frustrating because here they are trying to hold out hope and maybe give some answers to Lynn.
Yeah, there should have definitely been a go-between to kind of get them the information that they need to kind of like keep them in the know. Not having that is kind of like, it's just, it's so distasteful because it's like, yeah, you want to be appreciative that you're getting help in the, you know, the assistance of finding out how, you know, who did this to my daughter, but it should be way more easier to communicate back and forth.
It should be. And, you know, at this point, because what happened to Lynn was so traumatizing and she'd suffered so many injuries, she couldn't remember.
Yeah.
So finally on May 11th, 2016, 24 days after discovery, investigators were able to track down Angela Whiteman in Billings, Montana. When she was brought in for questioning, she told the story about what happened that night from her perspective. Now, remember, we have to take her point of view with a grain of salt and realize she may be saving herself a bit here. But even if she's trying to save herself, like, you're going to see how bad she looks in this version of the story. And, like, you can only imagine how bad things really were that night if this is her trying to save herself.
Oh, it's just one of those, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
It's going to be rough, guys. So she said that on Saturday night, she and DiMarzio, her boyfriend, were gambling and drinking at the bar. They were hanging out with two other females, and these two females were seen in the video. They were minors, so their names were excluded from the records. It was just their initials, but the two are going to confirm that it was DiMarzio and Angelica that were at the bar. She had seen that Lynn was crying at the bar for some time. So as she and DiMarzio were headed out, she gave her a pack of tissues. Lynn gratefully turned around and asked for a ride. She said she wanted to go back to Crow Agency. Now, DiMarzio was from Busby, so that meant that they would have to drive 24 miles past where they were going and another 24 miles back.
Okay.
So it would be really out of their way. And Angelica said that she told her yes, that they wouldn't mind the drive. So this is what the question that it's a rhetorical question I'm just going to send out there. Were they planning something nefarious from the beginning? Because why would they agree to do something that was so out of their way and being nice and then it turned so bad?
Well, that's true, right? Because they're not doing it out of the kindness of their hearts. So I don't think that they're the type of people that would do that. You know what I mean? So it's possible that maybe they planned on doing something.
Yeah.
Maybe not to this extent.
Right.
Or, you know, if they are involved, but, you know, maybe something.
Yeah. The way this plays out is very bizarre.
It is strange.
So when they left the bar with Lynn to start the drive, they met up with DiMarzio's brother, Frank Sanchez, who was not home. Okay. He was there, but he was waiting for them in the parking lot. So the four of them pile into the car and head north to get to Highway 212. So now Lynn is in the back seat with Frank, Angelica's in the passenger seat, and DiMarzio's driving. And Angelica confirmed that none of them had met Lynn before, and Lynn didn't know any of them. So it's just a stranger interaction here. As they were driving, Angelica said she was doing her hair and makeup in the mirror. She saw Lynn looking at her, and it irritated her. She asked, "Why are you looking at me like that?" And Lynn replied, "No reason." This further infuriated Angelica, and while they were driving, she reached around from the front passenger seat and started fighting with Lynn. She admitted that she was grabbing her hair and punching her in the face. She said that Lynn was trying to fight back as best as she could from the back seat. She said that she was furious with Lynn, and she told DiMarzio to pull over. And her words were, "This bitch can walk to crow." Instead of pulling over, he turned down Castle Rock Road and drove up about 3 miles. Again, your intentions can't be good.
No, they can't be at all.
The length of the road is 3.9 miles, so he almost gets to the end of it. As I said earlier, this meant that they were only 6 miles into their trip westward on Highway 212. So they were 18 miles away from Crow Agency. So even if they were going to say, "You can get out and walk," that would have been an 18-mile walk she would have had to
do.
But there was a reason that DiMarzio did not just drop Lynn off at the side of the road. Instead, he drove further down. And when they all got out of the car, according to Angelica, she, DiMarzio, and Frank participated in the beating of Roy Lynn until she was unconscious.
That's crazy.
So the three of them started attacking her, hitting her, kicking her. She was in a fetal position on the ground. She goes into a state of unconsciousness.
Literally over nothing.
Nothing.
A stare? A look? Maybe she was admiring you putting your makeup on. Like, it could have been nothing. Like,
yeah.
And you're going to go beat somebody up, and all three of you? Like, you guys are big men for doing that.
It's crazy.
That is insane.
So there's two scenarios here. Either this was planned the whole time, and that was just something she used to begin it, or she got, like, upset. Or maybe she was jealous of her, or maybe something happened that triggered her to fight her. And then it was kind of like then the men got involved because they're not good people.
It could have been that she was jealous. Maybe that her boyfriend or somebody was looking at her. Yes.
Yeah. Still, according to Angelica, DiMarzio told her that she had to finish her off. He got a bandana and showed her how to choke Lynn with it. Angelica said that she had to do it, so she did. I don't think that she had to do it. She choked Lynn until she stopped gasping for air. Her breath had stopped, but Frank said, "No, she's not dead. She's only blacked out." This implied that they still had to kill her. And for some reason, they wanted to inflict more pain on the 28-year-old mother. She said that Frank then stripped her naked. DiMarzio told his brother to get the gas from the vehicle. She saw that DiMarzio poured gasoline all over her body. Angelica, and then later Frank and DiMarzio, will still not admit to who lit the match. But they were all there. They're all responsible for it together. Someone did light the match. And once her body was ablaze, the three of them got back into the car and drove back down Castle Rock Road and back to Highway 212 and east towards the Northern Cheyenne Reservation. DiMarzio told them, "Don't look back." But in the mirrors of the car, all they could see were flames. They left her like that.
It's disgusting.
But as we know, Lynn did not die there. She survived the beating, the strangulation attempt, and being lit on fire. Somehow, most likely thinking about her son and her family, she walked 3 miles to get back to Highway 212.
Are you serious?
Yeah. Because remember, he drove up the road.
Oh, my God.
So once she got close to the road, she must have collapsed where the man found her the next day.
Right.
She spent the night there, 14 hours out in the open wilderness, burned with difficult breathing because the fire destroyed her throat and nasal passages. The temperatures that night reached as low as 43 degrees, with winds at 16 miles per hour. And that's how she developed frostbite on parts of her body that were not burned. Her suffering is inconceivable.
That is so sad that somebody had to endure that, spend the night in the freezing cold while being burnt
for nothing
and beaten and choked out. I mean, this is horrible. This is so bad.
So now that the agents had heard the story, it made even less sense to them. Why, they asked her. Why would you do that to her? Angelica told them that she couldn't explain it. Instead, she made excuses, saying it was because of alcohol. Once they got this story from Angelica, both Frank and DiMarzio were interviewed again. They all told conflicting accounts of what happened that night. And they all passed more blame on each other than themselves, which is to be expected. On June 22, 2016, Angelica Whiteman and DiMarzio Sanchez were charged with assault with intent to commit murder, as well as aiding and abetting. But 6 days later, Roylynn Rideshorse would lose the fight of her life. Her family was with her during her last moments. Her mother stroked her hand and told her, "Lynn, it's okay. Don't be afraid, and I won't be afraid." She told her daughter to fall in God's arms. And Lynn, with tears streaming down her face, said, "Okay." Ernestine told her, "We'll be okay. You'll be okay." And then Lynn peacefully passed away on her own terms. After Lynn's death, the charges against Angelica Whiteman and DiMarzio Sanchez were upgraded to first-degree murder, as well as aiding and abetting. Frank Sanchez was also arrested and charged with first-degree murder, as well as aiding and abetting. Frank, who was 21 at the time, pled guilty to charges of misprison of a felony, which is defined as being responsible for a crime committed by another that must in some way make the contribution from his will an accessory after the fact. So he was sentenced to 9 years in prison. After his 9 years in prison, he would have to spend 3 on supervised release and pay $14,276.72 in restoration. According to a press release from the U.S. Attorney General's office, Frank Sanchez was present and witnessed the assault, but failed to notify authorities. So they were able to determine that Frank didn't really participate in the physical assault, but he was there.
Right. He was a witness to something so egregious and did nothing about it.
Right.
I mean, I think you're equally as responsible at that point.
Right. And he got 9 years. He lied to law enforcement about his knowledge of the crime when he was first interviewed by denying, A, that he was even present, and then giving investigators a false alibi. When re-interviewed almost 2 weeks later, after they found Angelica, Frank Sanchez provided a truthful account. In addition, Frank Sanchez failed to turn over to law enforcement the victim's jeans, which DiMarzio Sanchez had given him and another person to dispose of. Angelica, who was 26 at the time, pleaded guilty to her crimes and was sentenced to 40 years in prison and 5 years of supervised release after that. She was also ordered to pay the same amount of money as Frank in restitution. DiMarzio Sanchez, who was also 21, decided to take his case to trial. It was a painful ordeal for Lynn's family to go through. He was eventually found guilty by a jury and sentenced to mandatory life in prison with 5 years of supervised release and a restitution payment the same as the other two perpetrators. DiMarzio Sanchez tried to appeal his sentence in June of 2022, stating that the U.S. attorneys had persuaded Frank and Angelica to state that he was the aggressor, so he would get more time. It also states in his appeal that he wasn't happy with his counsel, but most disgustingly, he was trying to claim that he had not been the cause of death, that the cause of death was the infections from the skin grafts not healing. Now, dude, she had to do the skin grafts because of what happened to her.
Exactly.
Wild. They were saying, like, trying to claim she wasn't getting the correct care at the hospital. Wild. His appeal was denied.
Well,
thank God.
Yes.
We don't know why Roy Lynn had to die that night, or whether, when she was left vulnerable and abandoned by her abusive boyfriend at the bar that night, those predators planned what they did to her. What we do know is that the indigenous women in this country need their stories told. Whether it's about domestic violence, a missing persons case, or murder, their stories will shine a spotlight on a problem that is plaguing their communities and our country.
It's really sad.
And that goes for other countries too, because it is the same in others.
Oh yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, I mean, this is so sad. I mean, you feel like every other time, right? You feel bad for the family, the mother that tried to stop this. It's just that Lynn just seemed to be the target for, you know, all these people, you know, her ex-boyfriend that left her there, that really, like, facilitated the rest of this to even happen.
Right.
I mean, I'm not saying that, like, he's responsible for that, but, I mean, he was an abuser. I mean, he was neglectful. He should have never left her at that bar.
Agreed.
That is the mother, you know, you could say whatever you want. I don't care. That is the mother of your child. You don't just leave her at a rando bar 30 plus miles away,
yeah,
with no way to get home and without the means to seek a ride, you know, like whether it be like, you know,
yeah,
there's no taxis,
there's
no way to get home. Right. So she was put in a predicament by taking that ride with those three people.
Yeah.
It's horrible. Everybody let her down there. Everyone, her ex-husband, her ex-boyfriend let her down. You know,
the people that picked her up. Everyone else at that bar.
Someone could have intervened or saw it. I mean, I know it's hard, but still, it's just sad to see a mother that loses her life for no reason at all. It's disgusting, you know?
It's crazy. And the similarities to the other case we covered are also, like, insane.
It's true, actually. That's what I was getting, like, flashbacks. Yeah, yeah, like, you know, from that case that we covered.
It was rough.
It was.
Yeah. Okay. So before we go, what we want to do is something we always do. We want to thank our new supporters on Patreon. And if you want 2 extra bonus episodes a month, you can join us at patreon.com/truecrimecouple, or you can just find us on the Patreon app. So we want to say thank you to Vivianne Minibach, Michelle Delaney, Melissa Paragallo, Carolyn, Dia Carey, Erica Miranda, Woman Interrupted, Bobby Slaughter, Lene Nise, Christina Farmer, Megan Parzak, Macy Stewart, Nicole Guru, Annie Garcia, Elisa Graybill, Lotus Up Their Pledge, Rachel, Crystal White, Chase Fowler, Cindy Cunningham, Amber Worthington, Helen Hume, Danny Johnson, Terry Goolsby, Kimberly N., Taylor Stickler, and Kev. Thanks so much for joining Patreon. We hope you're enjoying all of those backlogs of episodes. And until next time, guys, don't park next to vans.
Bye, guys.
Bye.